This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 31 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Football analytics aren't there to give you all the answers, but they're intended to get you closer to the answers. I've often asked, especially on early episodes of this podcast, why there are people out there who willingly ignore and even bash analytics when all analytics do is help provide more context to things that our eyes can't see or consume. I would guess that some are doing so, some are knocking analytics and numbers because they don't understand them and they feel threatened. It's a new way of looking at the game, and if they're not part of that, they don't like it. To be fair, that's truly, I think, just a small portion of the anti-numbers population, because I think most folks who don't like analytics don't because there's too much happening. There's analytical saturation. People are making stats about stats about stats. And I can't even disagree. It's important to remember that data itself is never wrong. It's the analysis and utilization of that data that can be wrong. But the truth is, some data is also better than other data. A wide receiver's air yards, for instance, is more useful both in the descriptive and predictive sense than a wide receiver's drops. If I were to give you a wideout's air yards profile versus the number of drops he had in a single year, you'd be able to tell me a lot more about the talent or worth of a wide receiver via his air yards. On top of this, data makes a lot more sense to utilize in fantasy football than in real football. Don't get me wrong, using analytics to provide real football context is super beneficial. Teams and front offices are doing this on top of their film grinding evaluations. Fantasy football, though, is a numbers-driven game. There's an actual, tangible end goal that we're trying to analyze, and it's a number. Fantasy points scored. You don't have that with real football. Talent, in general, is impossible to quantify because it's not tangible. So given this, given the fact that we're aiming to figure out how many fantasy points these players are going to score, we can use data in a more concrete and specific manner. In fantasy football, data that leads us to fantasy points is data that's more important than data that doesn't. But what type of data is that? What type of data should we be paying more attention to? And what type of information can you avoid? Because look, I get it. You're not crunching numbers like I am each day. It's not because you're incapable. It's because you've got a job, you've got a family, you've got other responsibilities. My job is to help you be better at fantasy football. And I think part of that is by talking through which statistics and metrics matter, what you should be looking for numbers-wise, and what you can ignore. While I talk about these things in random podcasts, why not talk about it in one concise show? I won't be doing it alone, though. Rich Rebar, or @LordReebs, the man with a Zach Morris avatar on Twitter, is my main dude. He's become a great friend of mine over the years that I've been doing this, and he's my go-to when I've got random football thoughts and just want an opinion on something. And it's because Rich is amazingly smart, is incredibly good with numbers, and just understands the game of football from both a real and fantasy sense. There's no other person on this planet who's better suited to talk through the issue of data saturation and finding not just all data, but the right data to be a better fantasy football player. Anytime you listen to Rich, you're bound to learn something new. I'm sure that'll be the case once again. Rich, let's start off this conversation with a higher level question. When you're analyzing a particular player heading into a fantasy draft, what are the key components, the metrics or statistics that you're looking for in that player?
So when it comes to data that I care about or want to begin with, I mean, you want to start with just playing time and opportunity more than anything. I mean, to put it simply, I want players on the field and I want ones that are being used while on it. I mean, fantasy football is a game of counting stats. And the path to tallying them is first by being on the field and then receiving the opportunities to touch the football. This is where the first intersection, you know, kind of perceived talent versus output and fantasy actually comes into play. You know, we get that riff. Great players can't be great fantasy ones if they aren't playing or touching the ball. And pedestrian talents, no matter how they're perceived, can still be fantasy stars if they have a significant role in an offense. I mean, fantasy football is a lot like, you know, Hollywood in that respect. You know, by and large, we'd all agree that Vin Diesel isn't a great actor on the level of like Leonardo DiCaprio, but we'd all agree that Vin Diesel is most definitely a huge movie star. I mean, same for fantasy, you know, any given year for a number of players, you know, guys like LeGarrette Blount last year are a good example. Volume and franchise is important because opportunity presented to specific when it comes to players, all come under the umbrella of team production, you know, which is why having a top-down view of historical play calling and play volume come into play when analyzing that opportunity for a player. A lesser opportunity in the Saints offense can be equal or greater to a greater opportunity in the Browns offense. And the inverse can be because we inherently want to pursue the situation that presents the highest play volume and opportunity to produce those counting stats. I mean, offensive attachment based on available opportunity is how a player like Jarvis Landry last year managed to post nearly identical target share numbers, but managed to still lose 35 targets on the season. I mean, you've probably heard the potential pedestrian projected target share for Michael Thomas mentioned a time or two this offseason as it relates to the other receivers surrounding his ADP. But over the past several seasons, you know, you look at the Saints, their lead wide receiver or tight end, if you want to include Jenny Graham, just count as their lead receiver, has steadily received only roughly around 20% of the team targets. But 20% of the Saints targets is still greater or equal opportunity of a pass catcher that sees 25% of targets on a team that only throws 500 times a year. You know, this is the Dez Bryant volume effect. I mean, Dez has averaged 25.3% of his team targets per game over the past 5 years, but has cracked 140 in a season just once over his career. He's had double-digit targets in just 23 of 73 individual games over his span because of the offensive attachment he's in. So we're talking about taking in team projections and play splits, that is, and we should be incorporating a range of outcomes for those. You know, is this team going to over exceed its win margin? You know, is it going to hit it? Is it going to fall below? Then cutting up that pie in terms of the opportunity it creates and, you know, in terms of play splits for the components of their individual offense before we even start layering in like rate efficiency data on an individual player level at all.
Right, right. First off, that Vin Diesel analogy was spot on and amazing. I can always count on you to come in with some amazing analogies, and you definitely hit a home run with that one. But to your point, volume is king in fantasy football. That's what we're looking for. However we can find that volume, and obviously not all volume is created equal, as you said. Michael Thomas in the Saints offense is not the same as Kenny Britt in the Browns offense, but volume overall is king, and if you take that top-down level approach, that's kind of how you understand and look at player evaluation from the start. But there has been some debate within the fantasy football community, at least on social media, regarding the importance of volume versus rate stats. We obviously just talked about how volume is very important, and I found that year-over-year rate stats don't correlate very strongly for players. For example, fantasy points per target for wide receivers just aren't very sticky. They have a correlation coefficient of 0.01 year-over-year. Now, mind you, that's the entire group of wide receivers that I'm looking at, so obviously at the extremes, you might be able to find useful information. But with that being said, have you found this to be true overall? When you're looking at a player and trying to project what he's going to do in the upcoming season, how do you work through what he'll do efficiency-wise?
Yeah, I mean, no matter how we slice things up and how many advanced metrics we create, at the end of the day, fantasy football is about only a handful of counting stats. Those counting stats stem from various forms of efficiency, but the all-important statistic we kind of hit on is opportunity. But once we create that opportunity, you know, things run to a mountain of variance, because even from a top-down view, efficiency in the NFL is unbelievably volatile and carries a staggering low rate of correlation coefficiency, like you hit upon. I mean, football is a sport where even the strongest correlation coefficients leave a massive room for variation. I mean, for example, mm-hmm. the highest year-over-year of a correlation for a team output on statistic level we have is team pass completions. But it only carries, you know, an R squared of 0.43, you know, not even, you know, glass half full. That's the best we got for team statistics. And the strongest measure we have, you know, for an individual level is basically receiving targets, which is, you know, 0.53. So, I mean, we're still leaving a lot on the board. When it comes to football, the data we have available is largely still ends up being more descriptive than predictive still. You know, year-over-year efficiency is where correlations may come to die, but that doesn't mean we have to throw the baby out the bathwater when using efficiency data in your fantasy analysis. I mean, you can still take descriptive data points and backwards engineer a predictive measure through, you know, simple regression analysis, which is you can use often. It's basically become like what I do. That's just basically my hallmark now. I mean, volume may be the king of fantasy football and for regression analysis, but there's no better way of applying them, you know, through the lens of historical league-wide and individual career trends. An entire NFL season is inherently a small sample, so rate stats don't always course correct themselves like they would in NBA or a Major League Baseball. Matt Ryan's 2015 season is a strong example where you can apply layman's regression analysis that would have put you onto him being a strong value in 2016. And everything in his 2015 season lined up with his career output except for his TD rate. And of course, you got massive extra kickback on the recoil from his historic 2016 season, and you can basically apply regression analysis to Matt Ryan again. You're still going to have misses along the way, but focusing on means for teams and players will allow those misses to be much tighter to the target. When projecting, and incorporating efficiency into the volume that we talk about being all important.
Yeah, and speaking of projections and player projections, when you're creating those projections, naturally you're looking at things from a season-long standpoint. But both of us know that that can get you into a lot of trouble. I've talked about that on this podcast many times. So can you explain why looking at the potential of a player in bulk can get these fantasy owners in trouble, and maybe why someone like Todd Gurley last season, while he looked okay from a season-long finish standpoint, he was a high-end RB2, low-end RB1, was even worse, though, than most realize.
Yeah, Gurley is a strong example. Perhaps Frank Gore, each of the past few seasons, is like the hallmark of what we're discussing here. I mean, Gore is a guy who has back-to-back RB1 seasons and overall fantasy output, but has been an RB1 in just 6 of 32 games over that span. He's cleared 15 PPR points in his 8 of those games, which on average, kind of equates to the weekly RB16 over the past 5 years in a given week. I mean, overall production is where you can really spot that being – just being active for a full season is an overrated commodity sometimes for fantasy. The Jason Witten effect. How many times have you heard the drop? Jason Witten has been a tight end one every year of his career since his rookie year. I mean, it's quite an accomplishment in itself. It means something. But overall, Jason Witten hasn't been a tight end in points per game, the past 2 years. He gets elevated in bulk production because he is always on the field. He never misses games. I mean, there's value in availability, but by and large, we're still talking about player performing at a weekly level that has a higher level of replaceability than what is being suggested by his end of season rank. I mean, that's why it's important to, we talked about earlier, incorporating a range of outcomes into your approach for a specific player over just linearly following just one set of projections. I mean, projections are the most probable full season scenarios we come up with. But again, you don't want to just blindly charge ahead with just those being, gospel. I mean, if we're holding the fantasy industry to what is defined as accuracy into high account, I mean, the best, the very best of us, have a hit rate that resembles Shaquille O'Neal's career free throw percentage. I mean, relying on the confidence of vacuum projections is a part of reasons why you should never, subscribe to something like value-based drafting, tying into projections just being like your entire draft plan. If you have a lot of things go wrong, I mean, because even if we are supremely accurate in nailing those end game numbers, what the hell are we even really saying? I mean, those numbers still mean wildly different things for how a game on a weekly game like fantasy football is played. I mean, take for example last year, Travis Kelce and Greg Olsen. They had nearly identical overall season statistically a year ago, and counting stats that are scored for fantasy football. And at the end of the season, they were the first and second highest player in scores at their position. Kelce had 85 catches for 1,125 yards and 4 touchdowns. Olsen had caught 80 passes for 1,073 and 3 scores. On a per-game level, they were just 0.3 receptions, 3.2 yards, and 0.6 touchdowns apart in production. But depending on who you had rostered in fantasy, had drastically different results for different moments in the season. Through 9 games, we know Kelce was pretty much trash. He was a top 4-12 scorer in just 4 of his first 9 games. So in less than half of Kelce's opening 9 games played, which was roughly 75% of your fantasy regular season, he didn't even turn in a starting caliber performance based on his position. On the other hand, Olsen started off, the opposite way. He had 7 top 12 scoring weeks through that 9-game stretch, and 6 of those 7 being a top 6 scorer. He was carrying you to start the year, and then we knew how the rest of this play out. Kelce ended up goes nuclear over the final stretch. Cam and Olsen, like, they fall apart. Olsen does nothing the back half, but the end of the season will show you that these guys were equal on a broad scope. But the way fantasy football scored and played shifted the values of each player significantly over the course of the season. Similar projections can still mean different things at the end of the day. So if you're going to base your draft strategy off of that, you have to take that into context. You're just not getting bulk end of the season numbers and have them divvying up evenly across 16 games. I mean, that's just one anecdotal example used to make a point. But, I mean, there's a litany of others that are similar if you go scour the positions. I mean, football, and most importantly for context, the fantasy side, is a game that is tied, that goes into the results of each week that are going to vary week to week. This will always be a game that is driven by just pockets of production and the timing of that production, which is just wildly variant and unpredictable. I mean, there are a handful of David Johnson type of week-to-week players available per season that offer an edge in sustaining elevation above, you know, replaceability, but there's a reason why those guys cost as much to get. You know, so I mean, yeah, definitely the numbers, you can be even a great projector and it still mean totally nothing.
Right. You know, I mean, think of it this way. If you're meeting, let's say you're meeting friends at the beach for a vacation, right? Your friends end up flying there, but you're driving there. But in the end, you're both getting to the same location. Well, that's what projections are looking at. They're just right. looking at the fact that you got to that location. They're not looking at how you got to that location. I think that's the one thing that you and I both have tried very hard to push, is that it's not just about that projection. It's not just about that end number. While fantasy points scored is what we're aiming towards, we have to look at the tools to get to that point in the best way. So I want to shift our focus a little bit more on specific metrics. Are there metrics in the preseason or before the season starts that you see fantasy analysts or players using that just should be thrown in the trash because they're just not necessary?
All of them?
Yeah, right, exactly.
And none of them. I mean, it's a, you know, half joking, but I mean, just like we've kind of been rolling around here, even the best football stats leave a large opening for failure. But on the other hand, almost everything is useful to agree if you apply it to the proper context.
Right.
I mean, I will say that I do express caution on the data surrounding subjective statistics. I mean, things like drops, off target balls, you know, from quarterbacks and receivers, missed tackles are events that just are wildly sparse. They have wildly sparse definitions.
Right.
And they can just be applied to a plethora of distorted contexts, especially when that charting isn't directly tied into fantasy production. I mean, Carlos Hyde's probably the poster boy for this. I mean, you see a number of positive Carlos Hyde data points brought up all the time, but when it comes to what really matters in what's scored fantasy football, I mean, he's poor in those areas. And you know, hasn't produced because of the things that matter. I would also express caution on, you know, a number of efficiency metrics that are just an extension of efficiency metrics already in place. I mean, no matter how we slice things up, and we're going to end up starting to say the same thing over and over again. Like the kind of say we're coming up with these statistics that are within a statistic that end up with kind of a redundancy, you know, echo chamber from the original metric in the first place.
Right.
A lot of target and touch metrics dive into a proxy of something that's already in place that you don't really need to shave down that greatly. In the end, we're largely talking about a small handful of contributing factors that truly affect the few counting stats that we're chasing in fantasy. And the more we end up saying is really just an exercise is adding confidence over increasing accuracy. I mean, no matter what you think of how like 538 covered the election, Nate Silver is one of the strongest prognosticators we have and has always preached that your model should, you know, reach its conclusion with as few data points as possible. Mm-hmm. If you're going to extend something like yards per target, it needs to yield massively different results than yards per target did in the first place.
Right.
You know, and apply that to whatever. I don't want to pinpoint any other specific metrics that people have come up with, but I mean, I've kind of shifted away from not trying to come up with, you know, new things and just kind of harness on, you know, taking what we have and applying it better. I will say that I also kind of believe that cornerback versus wide receiver analysis is kind of running rampant, but still not quite harnessed and applied correctly fully. Mm-hmm. I definitely believe it matters. Don't get me wrong, I definitely don't want to take that track here, but largely only at the extremes of teams and individuals and with the proper context. A lot of fantasy ball stats have a lot of gray area that a lot is inherently variant, and this is one of those. It's highly combustible, like a lot of fantasy stats. There are only a handful of shadow corners in the league, only a handful of 100% avoid secondaries. In the majority of cases, a starting wide receiver on a pass-heavy team is only running in the neighborhood of 35 routes per game and running them from different positions on the field. More often than not, an individual player is only finding a specific matchup, you know, 40 to 50% of those 30 to 40 routes that we're talking about on the higher end. And we're not even incorporating man versus zone coverage in the analysis yep. factors, as well as, you know, target opportunity for the players involved, whether it be the receiver and the cornerback, how often each is targeted. And we're finding ourselves getting pushed off of players too often in that gray area, I believe, because an individual matchup that falls in those gray areas is just inherently smaller than is suggested from the original analysis.
Yeah, I also think, you know, of course there are huge discrepancies between a top corner and a second corner on some teams, but I'm also a firm believer that a strong secondary trumps one strong cornerback. You know, I think that a huge point to make is that if a secondary is good as a whole, it's probably not just because one cornerback is good. It's because there are other pieces within that secondary that are allowing that secondary to be good and in a void from a fantasy standpoint. So I think that while I do agree, you know, I totally agree that it's not as though cornerback matchups are worthless to analyze. Of course, if there is a shadow corner, especially who's dominant, you don't want to target a wide receiver necessarily who's playing against that specific cornerback. But overall, you're going to get very similar results or yield similar results when looking at matchups. When you're just looking at advanced metrics like our schedule-adjusted passing defense metric that we use at NumberFire and things like that, where you're looking at the secondary as a whole, because like you said, wide receivers are moving around the field a lot. They're not just lined up against that one corner. Very few corners are actually shadowing week in and week out. And as a result, you just get a lot of noise when you're pinpointing and targeting that one specific corner wide receiver matchup. On the other side of the spectrum, what's one form of numbers-driven analysis that isn't talked about enough throughout the industry in your eyes?
I mean, I kind of hinted I'm not a holy grail skeleton key guy yet for fantasy data, but I still believe game scripts and turn play calling and players playing with offensive leverage is something that still isn't wholly applied or factored in like greatly. But I have some more takes on that for something down the road that we'll talk about. I mean, you'll see more of it out there, but a lot of telling signs for a team situations get swept under the rug when we just want to focus on talent analysis this time of the year. I'm someone who plays things close to the vest in the line of probability. So I try to take advantage of those aspects as greatly as possible, especially in like arbitrage situations, you know, from a guy we talked about, you know, kind of building our tiers or buckets of players from players that score similarly, not just the guy we think is going to score the most points. Well, how does this guy score his points and what's the line of that? You know, someone from the gap from Jordan Howard and ADP to Isaiah Crowell to the gap from Isaiah Crowell to Carlos Hyde. Those are all things that can be, you know, kind of exploitable in the team building context, you know, based on where players are falling in your draft board. I'll add also, too, that we're at a blessed time in what's becoming available to public consumption that is allowing us to further our opportunity approach that we talk about. It's the most important thing that we want to attack first. I mean, team snaps are now have become readily available everywhere now, when they used to only be available at like a handful of sites. We've got Pro Football Focus charting routes run by players on those snaps now. We're also finally getting offensive personnel packages made available, which is sensational for us who want to solidify that accuracy and available team opportunities. We now have the opportunity to see that a team like the Giants use three or more wide receivers on 97% of their pass plays, which is 20% higher than the league average, you know, and down the line for whatever else you're looking for. I mean, as that sample of availability begins to grow and continues to grow, it stands to be highly, you know, applicable for us that want to project opportunity more accurately. And that's something that I'm very excited about in the fantasy industry.
Rich, I want to talk about the red zone, because if we're being real, it's really kind of an arbitrary way of looking at scoring or scoring potential, since it's randomly defined as the area of the field between an opponent's end zone and the 20-yard line. Yet, you and I mean, we still reference the red zone when we're writing content. It's still a thing. But when analyzing the game, how do you look at red zone volume? Are you dividing things up by within the 20 and within the 15 and within the 10 and within the 5 to get more of a read on usage in that important area of the field? How are you looking at this red zone data? Because I think that it's one thing that not only analysts, but fantasy owners tend to gravitate towards a lot when analyzing players and situations.
Yeah, and I just had an article on red zone usage last week, and until fantasy begins to change how it's scored, I mean, really the statistic, we talked a lot about metrics, but the statistic that really only matters in fantasy football is touchdowns.
Right.
I mean, that's really it. By the end of each Monday night, the one thing that generally matters the most in deciding the outcome of your weekly matchup and winning DFS coin comes down to touchdown output. It's hard to win fantasy games without producing your opponent in the touchdown department, given how the foundation of fantasy football scored. I mean, it hasn't changed. I mean, touchdowns are the holy grail to us, and the way to score touchdowns is by getting closer to the goal line. And that's no different when we're talking about red zone plays, even though we include those plays from all encompassing the red zone. I mean, inherently, we know that a play from the 19-yard line isn't as valuable as one from the 5-yard line, right? But they get lumped together in analysis all the time. Over the past 5 years, 68.4% of all passing touchdowns in the red zone have actually occurred from the 10-yard line and in, with 60% of those touchdowns coming from the 5 yard line and in. Mm-hmm. Rushing scores, you know, get shrunk down even further, obviously, because we know a rush doesn't go for us the length of a pass. I mean, 72% of the rushing touchdowns over that span from the 5 yard line in over the past 5 years have come from the 5 yard line in, and 50% of those touchdowns coming from the 5 yard line and in have come from just 2 yards or closer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking about getting right next to the doorstep here. I mean, the rate of rushing touchdowns per opportunity doesn't even hit a 25% success rate until we get inside of the 5 yard line. And it doesn't even equal pass attempts until we're at the 1 yard line. I mean, passing touchdown rates cross the 25% mark, you know, having a quarter chance inside the 10-yard line, and that doubles up pass attempts from the 15 yards out or further inside the red zone. So, I mean, we really shouldn't care about those deep red zone plays, obviously. I mean, once inside of the 5 yard line, they hit 40% success rate passing while reaching 52%, you know, at the 1 yard line, even though they get significantly dwarfed by rushing opportunity there in terms of play calling. I mean, when talking about the red zone, we should really be emphasizing inside of the 10 yard line for the passing game and inside of the 5 yard line for both, really, as the big money zones. And we really should be just treating each individual yard line as a true representation of opportunity. And someone like Mike Clay with his OTD metric has done a fantastic job of bringing that to the forefront. Although, you know, end zone targets, you've got to do some maneuvering to unearth if you're not scouring, you know, game APIs and stuff. But I mean, that's a pretty much a perfect way to describe, you know, the red zone as something like what OTD brings to the table.
Yeah. I think, you know, another example is really a lot of the expected points models that doesn't translate specifically necessarily to touchdowns the way that an OTD metric does. But you can do regression analysis, which is why I do that every year with especially our reception net expected points metric with wide receivers, because you're looking at how many points these guys are scoring from a real football standpoint, and you're saying, oh, they might not have scored many touchdowns, and you just put context around it. Like, obviously, a guy like Davante Adams is going to regress a bit, but he also has Aaron Rodgers, so you have to adjust for that. But at the same time, you're actually looking at each of those individual yard lines in those instances on the football field to help you more easily visualize and see how many touchdowns these guys are going to score. So Rich, we're talking about more specific data points. And while this might not be as data related as the other questions, do you think that strength of schedule is useful to analyze before the season begins?
I mean, we're in the field of prognostication, so yes. I mean, when projecting players too, I mean, we should also be projecting team defenses in our analysis as well. Year-to-year rollover in terms of defensive efficiency can be sporadic, but if we're projecting from a top-down view, we have a general idea already of ballparking individual and team defensive performance based on the offensive projections we've come up with as well. So I mean, combining the two shouldn't be something that we're just completely ignoring. The volume and lack, therefore, creation for offensive players in those matchups ties right into what where we want to project for defense. I mean, again, not, you know, bringing up two points in a row, Mike Clay is a guy that does this amazingly well. You see when he talks about his projections for his offensive players, it's tied into, you know, games and how he projects the schedule of winnable games on the schedule and stuff like that. You know, that all ties into how you're going to project a fantasy player. And the other thing is too, is that matchups on a surface level, you know, may be overstated in terms of fantasy analysis, but you know, fantasy stats are largely reciprocal. I mean, meaning they belong to both teams, and each team played a large part in creating them on a weekly level. You know, so which is where, you know, kind of adjusting for opponents comes into season play. And, you know, when looking back on a season, you can use like strength of schedule, adjust for opponent. But as far as incorporating, you know, strength of schedule into my draft plans, I want to look at the most predictable player teams on both sides of the ball, their respective matchups, you know, kind of in that front quadrant of the season and build from there. You want to burn as hot as soon as possible and stack wins in fantasy football. So I will factor in immediate blips like the Dallas passing game. You know, they started off with the Giants, Denver, and Arizona to start the season. I mean, when facing a decision or Dez Bryant or Jordy Nelson, that's probably going to be a tie-breaking scenario where I kind of ignore the guy that's going to probably come out of the blocks a little bit, you know, slower because he's in a predictable situation where those are defenses that are highly predictable and an offense that's not really great as a volume passing offense that is, like I said, has stronger predictability. Strength schedule, I feel, is also particularly useful at a predictable position such as quarterback play, which I tied into that dial situation. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely shouldn't just be completely ignoring it like a lot of people do because you can't hide from a rock and predict everything else and then just say, well, this isn't predictable.
Yeah. Yeah. When the season hits, Rich, you do an unbelievably popular worksheet column each week on RotoWorld where you dig into each matchup and provide important data and nuggets for fantasy footballers to utilize. Part of that worksheet includes team tendencies like opponent's plays per game, rushing percentage, passing percentage, and so on. Naturally, that type of information becomes increasingly more useful as the season goes on and as we get more data. But how do you formulate your opinions on matchups earlier in the season? So I know that you just talked about that with Dez Bryant, for instance. How do you go about utilizing that information? What type of data are you looking at to get to those conclusions?
Yeah, the goal of the worksheet is very similar to everything we touched upon. I mean, I want to provide a top-down view of the games, where the play volume and splits for each team come into play, and then layer in individual components of that matchup. I mean, the worksheet, like you said, it also progressively highlights more immediate data progressively as we move on. I mean, the specifics of that data are kind of a moving target for each player and team. I mean, we talked about, you know, pocket production. The pockets of production are what really matters. So I really try to bring a lot of that into the fold as the season moves along by focusing on more of like immediate output and trends that are exploitable underneath the season to date output that is referenced so often in articles and stuff like that. I do try to pepper in a few like fun, well, actually facts that really don't mean anything, that are predictable, but can make you sound cool when you're watching the game with your friends or your family. But in the beginning of the season, things are much tougher, like you hit upon. And I'll use more like broad and historical data points the first few weeks of the year as the current sample begins to take shape. I mean, fantasy football is much more of a game about consistent recalibration than it ever will be about ball prognostication, no matter what we think. I mean, but we have nothing but this on our fantasy drafts to talk about for 7 months. So binary player analysis dominates content for this stretch. I mean, the truth is you shouldn't approach fantasy football with the old school mindset of I have to win my draft, because you and your opponents are going to make a handful of mistakes during the process of your draft. I mean, preparing yourself for multiple range of outcomes heading in will lead you to selecting not only a better team during the draft, will also prepare you for swings that occur during the campaign. Bottom line is your draft's going to suck. Your opponent's drafts are going to suck. You should know that going in. Eat Arby's, endorsed by Denny.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So also with the worksheets, though, you talk about Vegas and you give Vegas information in the worksheet. How do you apply things like a game spread and implied team totals in season-long fantasy? Are they a part? I know that they're somewhat of a part of your weekly process.
Yeah, as a one-off correlation, there's not much behind implied team totals as being, you know, accurate, was one, even being accurate, and then two, having a direct relation to immediate fantasy output, but does offer a modest positive trend simply because when Vegas and teams miss high point totals, they generally still produce a lot of counting stats outside of just, you know, getting the final thing, actually producing the points that come with those. That's where they fall off. But point spreads are where it's at anyways. I'm a big proponent of targeting players on a micro and macro level that are on positive end of game script. I've done a wealth of game script posts over the years that have showed you want to pursue teams with consistent offensive leverage. And Vegas is much more stable in this regard, especially, you know, for fading negative game script players. You know, even in the passing game, which is often a misconception of something casual fantasy players want to spin as a positive narrative for passing games. Often if you've been in a draft, I'm like, a draft is because he's going to be throwing the whole time, you know. But that's not really true. 60% of top 12 scoring quarterbacks over the past 5 years have been favorites. Just 13% coming from teams getting 6+ points over the past 5 years. Those are those teams that are those heavy dogs that you're talking about. There's a linear drop off for favorites and spreads, but anything that I found is basically like 6 points in either direction is the real hot spot to target. Those numbers getting 6+ points follow suit across the board. Just 12% of top 12 running backs are over the past 5 years have gotten 6+ points, you know, 14% of wide receivers, just 17% of tight ends. In terms of the amount, because you might be saying, how many games are we talking about? In terms of the amount of NFL games that have qualified for, you know, that arbitrary cutoff sweet spot, I mean, the percentage is just 27% of QB1s in that span that are getting 6+ points are hitting that QB1 status versus 56% for the opposition of those games, 26% for running backs versus 55% for the opposition, 29% for wide receivers versus 50% for the opposition. So, I mean, picking winners only as a one-off factor isn't something I'm endorsing here, because the NFL is so volatile year to year in terms of predicting team success, but it's definitely on a weekly level something that you can incorporate. And like I said, the bigger the favorite, the better you get in terms of predicting which players to fade and elevate, you know, in those matchups, which has, you know, obviously daily fantasy consideration as well.
Yeah, I mean, to the quarterback point, Rich, it takes a garbage performance in the first place to create that garbage time. Blake Bortles sucks in the first three quarters of games. Just because he's good in the fourth quarter doesn't automatically make him, or statistically good, I should say, doesn't automatically make him a good fantasy asset. Before I let you go, Rich, I want your boldest, hottest take for the 2017 season. And, of course, I want that take to be backed by some interesting data.
Not narrative. We're not looking for narrative here.
Yeah, no narratives here. No narrative.
I'll go and say that right now, as far as having a hot take, you know, mid-July, I will say that Travis Kelce is already the most overdrafted player in fantasy from a game theory and positional output stance for the 2017 season. And it's probably only going to get worse as we go along. I mean, the first side, the game theory element is that tight ends don't mean a lot and we're not good at predicting them. On a per-week basis over the past 5 years, the tight end position per week has scored on average just 63% of the wide receiver position among the top 12 weekly scores, and just 71% on average of the running back position, where we're taking a one-off tight end 1 versus tight end 2 versus RB1 versus RB2. In terms of the overall spot, it's just 74% for the tight end 1 versus the wide receiver 1, and 81% in terms of the tight end 1 versus the RB1. As a floor, the average baseline tight end produces just 39% of the top scoring output at its respective position, while those marks are 54% for quarterbacks, 40% for wide receivers, and 32.9% for running backs. Tight ends may not have the replaceability level of the quarterback position, but that's the other solo starting position for fantasy. But, you know, stacking running backs to circumvent baseline performances are far more valuable, and the wide receiver baseline is right in line with tight ends, and you need more of those guys to factor in as well. I mean, your next thought might be, well, there's more running backs and wide receivers to occupy those top spots, therefore having an elite tight end is an advantage at a one-off position. But tight end has the least replicability of all positions for baseline output on a weekly level. Of the tight ends that produced at least one starting week in a season over the past 5 years, just 54% of their players produce multiple starting weeks for the season, and that number drops all the way to just 33% of those players that produce just five or more games of the entire season. In comparison for the other positions, it's 51% for quarterbacks to produce a starting week that went on to have five or more, to 47% for wide receivers, and 41% for running backs. In terms of opportunity costs for position versus position, taking a tight end early because he's elite is largely grasping at straws. In terms of Kelce himself, he just simply has a much lower floor than anyone is truly considering for the draft capital of his position. And we're basing almost his entire 2017 prediction off of a 1-4 game sample without Jeremy Maclin and a 7-game sample to close the end of last season. Kelce saw 16%, 29%, 34%, and 38% of the KC targets in the 4 games that Maclin missed. He had 5 100-yard receiving games over the final 7 weeks after having just 3 through his 46 games played in the NFL. We're banking on an inherently small sample carrying an entire player here. Could roll over, could be really disastrous. I mean, Kelce's also being elevated by one of the worst tight end seasons in the modern era. In terms of the top 12 scoring players at the position had its worst season collectively since 2010. Just like the wide receiver position last year, where high-end tight ends were stung in the hardest area of declination was touchdown output, scoring 24 touchdowns, you know, collectively fewer than the year prior. Their fewest total since 2008 of the top 12 tight ends. It was the first NFL season in which no tight end scored more than 8 touchdowns since 2002. At the top spot, Kelce's tight end 1 scoring finish trumped the field in a context of 2016, but it was also the lowest scoring tight end 1 season in standard league since 2002, the lowest scoring PPR tight end 1 season since 2006. Like I talked about that declination of the position, like running backs had in 2015, we should anticipate the top of the tight end position to recoil some of their output because it was so heinously bad. And where they should recover it is in touchdown department. Guess who has consistently been a player playing in a situation that has not produced touchdowns? Travis Kelce. Even in a career year, Kelce has still never scored more than 5 touchdowns in a season. He's never even had the opportunity to score on the level as other peers at his position. He's totaled just 37 red zone targets over the past 3 years, just 13 targets inside the 10-yard line, and just 6 inside the 5-yard line. For perspective, Cole Beasley has matched Travis Kelce's opportunity inside the 10, and Kyle Juszczyk has more targets inside the 5 over the past 3 years. And his 2016 usage rates went up in terms of every level, you know, red zone, inside the 10, and inside the 5. The Chiefs ranked 26th in passing touchdowns since Alex Smith took over, 27th in passing yards. Taking a tight end early as Kelce is being drafted at that 2-3 turn has never really worked out positively for a sense of positional value, let alone accounting for opportunity cost at another position. And tight ends that have actually held this draft capital that Kelce has were significantly better touchdown producers and on teams that were significantly better passing teams. We're talking about Gronk, Jimmy Graham, Jordan Reed, and even Julius Thomas when he's on Denver. It just, I don't know. I'm just going to exit with my own air horns.
Rich, thanks so much for stopping by and talking fantasy football metrics. I and the listeners greatly, greatly appreciate it. If you aren't following Rich on Twitter, you can find him at Lord Reeves, and you can read his work over on rotoworld.com. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast by searching for the Late Round Podcast pretty much anywhere podcasts can be found, and leave a rating and review on iTunes if you could. It'd be greatly, greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'll be back later in the week with a mailbag episode.